Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you animal facts, wildlife updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. I love learning about new animals and this week's show was certainly that. Joined by biology PhD candidate and electric fish nerd, her words, Cassandra Ford, this show is all about electric fish. My brain was bubbling after this chat as Cassandra taught me so much about these incredible animals. We also spoke about an awesome study that Cassandra is currently working on, the changes in skull shape during the evolution of electric fish. I know, pretty cool, right? I went into this chat knowing nothing about these animals and came away learning so much, so I hope you share that experience with me too. Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. Hey Cassandra, thanks so much for joining me on Into the Wild. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm feeling quite relaxed today. Surprisingly, even though I've had like 4 or 5 coffees, I'm usually bouncing off the walls by now. But I'm doing well. How's life over stateside? You said you're south, so it's very hot.
Yeah, I live in Louisiana and it is quite humid and hot today. I think it's going to be a high of 93 degrees Fahrenheit. I have no idea what that is Celsius.
It's still considered very hot. We had it last week. We had a week of, so I'm gonna say it in Celsius now, so we had about 31 degrees Celsius, which I think roughly is about 95 pushing 100.
Yeah,
so it's it's not normal for London being a city. We don't like it. It's too much concrete, so it's,
it just bounces off
the floor straight into your face. Anyway, thank you so much for joining me on the episode today. I've been really excited to talk to you. Before we crack on with our conversation, can you just tell myself and my listeners who you are and what you do?
Sure. So my name is Cassandra Ford. I am a PhD candidate at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. And I am a graduate student studying electric fish from South America and Africa. And more specifically, I am looking at their skull shape evolution over time.
That is two amazing topics. This is why I'm so excited about this conversation. I sent you an email as well. I know nothing about these two things. So I feel like I'm just going to be reacting quite shockingly about the information I'm going to be hearing. But before we move on to electric fish, let's go back to the basics with yourself. How and when did your kind of interest for nature and wildlife begin for you?
Oh gosh, I've definitely always had an interest and passion for nature. The first time I ever went camping in the outdoors, I was actually only 3 months old.
Wow.
So I definitely started from a young age. But I was always, you know, good at biology in high school, kind of thought that that might be the direction that I wanted to go. But I wasn't really sure of all the options. And so honestly, for quite a bit of my undergrad career, I thought I wanted to become a veterinarian.
Yes.
And it wasn't, I think a lot of people have that.
Yeah, over here as well, yeah.
It pivots to something else. But it wasn't until a couple of classes later in my undergrad, I took evolutionary biology and a general ecology class that were a little more fieldwork based, evolutionary based, that I realized that I could actually go to graduate school and get a degree in this kind of thing. So it wasn't until I took those classes that I realized that I could actually get a degree in those particular topics and kind of delve into some research and do it that way.
So you said you went camping for the first time when you were 3 months old, which is amazing, like start them young. And was that in Louisiana as well?
No, so I'm actually from the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, cool.
The States. I was actually born in Texas and moved to Wisconsin when I was 3. But my parents actually met in college in Wisconsin, and they have this super fun tradition with a bunch of their college friends that they have actually gotten together annually every single year since college.
Wow.
To go on a camping trip with all of them, their kids, everything like that.
So you had no choice.
Yeah, so I mean, my mom had me in March, and by the time June and July came around, we were going camping.
Amazing. The wildlife, because I've never been to Louisiana, and it's one of those places I've always wanted to travel to in America, and I've not done a lot of America. What kind of wildlife do you see around you in Louisiana?
Oh goodness, Louisiana is a swamp. So we have gators in a lot of the like aquatic environments around here. Mm. So there are also a lot of like shorebirds and wading birds, like herons and egrets and stuff like that. But we're also a pretty big stop on the bird migration path every spring and fall. And so we get a ton of really cool kind of transient birds for a couple of weeks here that we get to look at.
Oh, that must be amazing.
Yeah, it's so cool. Our backyard this year is actually a little hot spot because we have a little water source in our backyard. And so we saw so many birds that we had never seen before.
That's so cool. And I'm going to ask this stereotypical question, probably for you, about Louisiana, because you say gators. How often do you see alligators in Louisiana? Are they as common as people think they are? Or is it kind of like, oh, we rarely see them?
So it depends on the situation. Like, day to day, I do not see an alligator unless I go to my university's campus, because we are one of the only universities in the States that has our own campus swamp, and that swamp has alligators in it. Amazing. So if I really wanted to, I could see an alligator on a daily basis. But if we're talking like, you know, real wild natural habitat,
yeah,
you could go to a local park and there's probably an aquatic area there that you could see one, but they're definitely not like roaming around our neighborhoods.
Because it's that thing with life in the UK with wildlife. I mean, I do hate saying that we've got boring wildlife over here, because obviously I don't think any wildlife is boring, but we don't have kind of top predators on that level, or like, and yeah. I love crocodilians, so it's just that thought of going, oh, I mean, you're having them on your campus. How wary do you have to be of these animals?
So, not too bad. I mean, we do have, like, brick kind of, a brick little barrier around the swamp and everything. Mm. But every once in a while, a gator does get a little too big for its britches and escapes. At which point, there's definitely photo or video documentation of the police officers trying to escort said gator back into the swamp. Taking it for a walk. It's hilarious.
Is it like that kind of people, because over here in the UK, and I promise you, this is the most exciting it gets at school or high school, when a dog runs on the school grounds. People lose their minds. People just get so excited.
Yes.
Is it the same excitement with a alligator walking around the campus, or is it more kind of, oh, watch your backs?
No, it's probably more excitement. It's like, oh, that's not... Oh, it's out. Oh my gosh, it's out. And people will probably like take out their phones. I mean, unless you really agitate the gator, like on an individual basis, it probably won't attack you. It's just kind of like, I'm a little sick of the swamp. I'm going to go to the concrete where it's warmer.
Yeah, exactly. They're very lazy animals.
When you have students running around, it's not exactly prime real estate.
The other thing I wanted to ask, because being swamp country, you must have, as well as crocodilians, but other reptiles there, like different snakes and stuff as well?
Yeah, we have definitely copperheads and cottonmouths are definitely around. And so in a lot of these like local parks and stuff that have the natural habitat, what they'll actually do is have raised platforms for their little walking trails. So you're not as likely to encounter like a snake that's, you know, going across a path or something like that. But I mean, for the most part, I think most people leave them alone around here, unless, you know, they're attacking a person or something like that. But no, they're pretty common.
And how, like, I mean, because obviously being a venomous snake, how wary, I say wary, obviously we're always aware of these animals, but how kind of risky are these animals in suburb areas of Louisiana as well with the snakes?
Not really. Honestly, they want to be left alone. They don't want to be running around your neighborhood risking having people encounter them.
Yeah.
So for the most part, they try to stick around, you know, their natural habitats,
which makes sense.
People if they can.
Yeah.
So.
But anyway, enough of snakes and alligators. I had to bring them up. Let's talk about electric fish, because like I said, I know zero about electric fish. It was only last year, and I'm going to be very embarrassed saying this as a nature person, I only learned that an electric eel wasn't an eel. So this is how much I don't know, Cassandra. So go with the basics. But let's talk about electric
fish. It's totally fun.
So first of all, how did you become a lover of these animals?
Well, cool. Like, you say the word electric fish and people immediately like perk up. They're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I was applying for graduate schools at different places across the country. Here, I think it's the same in most biology departments kind of worldwide, where you have to contact a potential advisor before you would start in the program. And so I actually got a cold email from the university that I'm currently at inquiring if I would be interested in applying to their biology program because of my GRE score and research experience. Mm. And so I took a look at the website. I knew I was looking for a fish guy or gal, some sort of fish advisor. And the advisor that I'm currently under, Dr. James Albert, was alphabetically one of the first people listed right there. And I read the description about how he studies taxonomy and evolution of electric fish, and probably like every other person, I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
And did some research on, you know, his work, electric fish in general, found out that there are a lot more electric fish than I ever thought that there were.
Really?
And pretty much fell in love and was like, well, I hope I get in here because this is about the only place that I want to go.
That's a really lovely organic way of finding out as well. Like, it's just kind of like you did the research and then fell for them. And you said there, like, there's a lot more than you thought there was. How many are we talking species-wise?
So there are about 240 species in South America. Whoa. And about 225 species in Africa.
Wow.
And that's not even counting other independent evolutions of electricity in fish. There are other fish, an example would be like a stargazer, that have also independently evolved some sort of little electric shock that they can generate.
Wow, so true... Was that true electric fish, I guess, would be about, was that about 500?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's pretty insane. I had no idea that there were that many before I started looking into it.
No, absolutely.
The thing that kind of sets these two groups, so the groups from South America and Africa specifically, sets them apart is that they're actually constantly generating an electric signal. It's not like, oh no, something's coming to eat me, I better shock that predator in like self-defense. This is actually a constant electric signal that they're emitting, that they're using for a bunch of different purposes, and so that kind of makes them a little unique.
Yeah. And when you say so, god, that's incredible. So they're constantly emitting it out. Is this and what are the different reasons why they would do that? Is that from a warning point of view as well, or is that a sense and environment?
So it's a little bit of both. We kind of go with they're using it for communication and sensory. So the signal that they're emitting is actually species specific. It's a little tiny bit different for every single species that's out there. There are actually a couple of species descriptions that you can't really tell them apart that well if you just look at them, but they have vastly different electric signals. And they're using that as identification for potential mates or potential competitors.
Yeah.
And so there's also some evidence in a lot of species for a very slight difference in the signal based on sex as well within the same species. And so given that, it's pretty reasonable to think that they're using it to identify mates and then figure out also who they're competing for mates with.
Yeah, so it's a real kind of, I was going to say a personal thing, but I don't like to humanize an animal, but it's a real kind of unique to that animal, what they're doing with it at the time, and it kind of changes, I guess, that electric current.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah.
But then they're also using it, as I said, for sensory purposes as well. So where these fish are living, it's like the Amazon River Basin and some flooded forests in that area. Along with the ones in Africa are more in the Congo Basin, going from kind of the western part of Africa and going inland. And all of those environments are incredibly turbid and muddy, and you can't really use vision all that much order to see anything about where you're going or where you are. And so by constantly emitting an electric signal, they're actually generating a really small electric field around their body. And so I think a lot of people at some point in science have probably played with magnets and, you know, created a little magnetic field around the magnets.
Yeah.
And if you put a magnet, like if you push a second one into that magnetic field, it changes. And the electric field or the magnetic field around that first magnet is altered when that other magnet comes in. And so it's kind of the same principle here with an electric signal, that if something, an object or another fish, enters a fish's electric field, they can sense that and know that there's something around them.
That's amazing. So they're almost, well, I guess it's, they're using it as a sonar kind of thing.
Yeah. Echolocation is another kind of example. Yes. That I kind of tell people sometimes because it's pretty easily recognizable as a sensory function.
And are they able to, like, use that current? Would they be able to tell not only that something has entered that kind of current that they're giving off, but would they be able to identify what or kind of what size, or whether it be predator or prey?
Most likely, yes. So all living things actually generate some sort of electricity. There are ions within all of our cells, and so in some sense there is kind of a little tiny bit of a background electric field that's generated by a living body. It's not really useful. We can't do anything with it or anything like that, but it is kind of there. And so these electric fish are able to use that information, use information from other electric fish. So if another electric fish comes into their electric field, there's kind of a little bit of like reverb that happens. Like they don't really like to be next to each other all that often
because sounds stressful.
Two electric signals like right next to each other, it's not too comfortable, I don't think. But also, I mean, just basic size of an object as well could probably have an impact on that kind of background little electric field that's found by the fish, you know, sensed by the fish.
Yeah, and I guess this might be quite hard to put into terms, but and you might want to pick a species to go with, because I know, like you said, now there's 500 of them. This is going to be a very big range. But how electric are they? When we say electricity, if we were to compare it to electric that we might know and understand, is there a comparison we can use?
Okay, so yes, this is kind of a little bit of like a misconception about electric fish, I guess. They're actually, I would say, like, we put them into two different categories. And honestly, the electric eel is all by itself in one of those categories.
Okay, cool.
It's pretty much the only electric fish that can generate enough of an electric discharge to actually shock anything.
Okay.
They use it for predation and for defense. Mm. And getting shocked by an electric eel is kind of like sticking a fork into a socket. Kind of,
oh, wow.
Like a nice little shock.
Yeah, you're going to know about it.
But depending on the electric eel, it can be stronger as well. There have been instances where an electric eel has actually stunned a horse and caused it to like fall over in the Amazon River.
Really?
But yeah. Yeah, they actually used to, like back in the day, they would bring horses through, like wade through the Amazon on horses because the eels would get the horses as opposed to the people that were trying to get across the river.
Oh, poor horses.
But I know, right? But the rest of these groups, like the rest of the, you know, 499 fish, approximately, they're all what we consider weakly electric fish.
Okay.
So if I could put 500 of those fish into a tank, wouldn't be healthy for the fish. But if I did, I could put 500 of them into a tank, stick my hand into the water and pick up a fish and I wouldn't feel anything.
Interesting. Okay.
And so they actually for a long time didn't even know that these fish were electric at all, because you can't hear anything, you can't see anything, you couldn't feel it. And so they couldn't tell actually until they started putting like guitar amp systems into the water, and then you can hear it. Then you can hear the electric discharge, but they had no idea before that. They're like, there's some weird kind of cells here that are probably doing something, but we don't really know what.
And is that why they put the guitar amps in? Was that because they thought something was happening?
So through taxonomy and stuff, they kind of figured that out that these fish were related to the electric eel. Mm. They're like, well, if the electric eel is electric, maybe these guys are too, and maybe that's what those cells are for. So it was definitely an iterative process. I mean, I props to the person who figured that out. Yeah. You know, it was like, I'm gonna stick a guitar amp in the water and see if I can hear these fish. That's not like, I don't know if I would have thought of that.
Well, that's why I asked as well, because I know my listeners now would have heard that bit of information and gone, all right, stop, why the hell did that happen? So when we, this is a silly question, I'm sure it's going to be a silly question, and but it might not be. How does the electric not cause damage to them when they're in water?
Okay, so it's a different kind of electricity than like the one that you and I are used to power our homes. It's okay. Not that kind of electricity. I mean, on like an ion basis, like way deep down in the weeds, it probably is. But these fish are using cells within their body, special kind of cells, to control that ionic change across the cell.
Yeah.
So before I mentioned that all of us kind of have a background level of electricity because we have ions in our body which have positive and negative charge.
Mm-hmm.
What these fish are doing is they're actually controlling where those ions sit within the cell. So there's a positive side and a negative side.
Okay.
And the electric current can flow through their body from one end to the other. And then it's going to go through the water around to the side that it's attracted to. And in essence, create an electric field.
Wow. God, that's incredible.
And so,
yeah.
Yeah. They're not damaged by water. But I will put a caveat on that in that they only live in fresh water. They don't live in salt water, which would have additional ions in the water and therefore render the electric field useless.
So when we're looking at electric fish, that they will only be in fresh water?
Yes.
Okay, cool. And when... So people can get an idea, because I really... It stumped me that there's so many species. I had no idea there were that many of them. What's the kind of sizes that we see from these fish?
So the electric eel is the biggest one. That particular fish, I believe the record has been about 5 feet long.
Whoa.
But average, I think, is 3.
Mm.
In terms of the rest of them, there are definitely some big examples of big species, especially in the African ones. But the electric fish that my lab focuses on, the South American ones, I would say the average is about 8 inches long.
Oh, okay, cool. So really from one extreme to another.
Yeah. Definitely some smaller fish, smaller species, and definitely some bigger ones as well.
Yeah.
But probably average would be like 8 inches to a foot.
Okay, cool. And how are they doing as a species regarding conservation with the... with the change of the planet that we're seeing around the world, how are electric fish in Africa and South America doing?
As far as we know, they're doing all right. We haven't had any concerns, and I think between all of the scientists that I know that study them and go and try to collect them, they have not seen any decreases in numbers.
Oh, wow.
But it's definitely something to, you know, keep an eye on, especially with temperatures rising, and they are freshwater only, so that could definitely have some issues moving forward if we see reductions in water levels at a freshwater level.
And can there be anything like, and this might be just completely plucked out of the air, but can, from the suburbs being built up more and more, or people probably more looking at South America from this, people living alongside the rivers, can that ever have an effect on electric fish? I know it has an effect on many fish, but from the point of the electrical currents and stuff, can that ever affect the fish or anything?
I can't see anything other than what would affect other fish.
Yeah.
As a potential problem, I mean, pollution, all of that is definitely a huge issue, especially in the country that I went to go and collect fish was Peru. Mm. And I went to the city called Iquitos, which is a little bit on the northern side of the country. And it's kind of a developing city. They're really rapidly getting a lot of technology, like cell phones and computers and stuff like that, at a higher level right now. Like, a lot more people have access to that. Mm. And they're also seeing a huge increase in pollution within all of the river channels that are in and around that city. And so that kind of thing is definitely going to have a huge impact on all of the organisms that are living in that environment. Yeah.
And you also specialize in the evolution of skull shape with electric fish. Can you tell me a little bit about this and what that kind of means?
Definitely. So I am, in essence, trying to compare shape. It's kind of an odd thing to think about and kind of an odd thing to do. But what, in essence, what I'm trying to do is quantify shape so that I can see how the skulls probably looked in the past, so like millions of years ago, and then also compare what they look like now. And so, are there similarities between the species? Are there distinct differences? Are there any instances of species that are not very closely related looking the same?
Yeah.
And so, in order to do this, I am using a few different methods. But my main method is using CT scans.
Oh, wow.
So it's also called a CAT scan in medical terminology. So I have gone to a laboratory where they have a little tiny tabletop CT scanner.
That's amazing.
I make a fish burrito. So I put as many little specimens of fish as I can into this little 3D printed container, stick it into the tabletop CT scanner and let it run for however long it tells me it's going to run. And what I get out is a 3D image of that fish burrito. And so I have all of the osteology or all of the bone morphology information about all of the species and specimens that I just scanned.
That's amazing.
And so, yeah, it's so cool. It's so much data though. And it is like, so computationally heavy to do all of this stuff. But in essence, what I do then is I isolate out the skull, because that's really the part that I'm interested in looking at right now.
Yeah.
And I use a method called geometric morphometrics in order to quantify the shape of the skull. And so how I kind of try to describe this is it's putting landmarks or points on important parts of the skull that I can easily identify on all species.
Okay, cool.
So an example for like a person who has no idea what a skull even looks like, so like kind of break it down a little bit more, would be if I wanted to compare the shape between a square and a trapezoid. So there are four points on each of those shapes. They're like four edges, four corners.
Yeah.
So I would put a landmark or a point on each of those corners, and then I can run statistical analyses to tell me how relatively different those shapes are.
Cool.
So these analyses kind of take size out of the equation. So size doesn't really matter when I'm talking about shape.
Yeah.
It'll rotate the shapes around to make sure that they're kind of the closest that they possibly can to each other. And then they're looking at the distances between those points. So are there huge differences? Is the trapezoid much different in shape than the square? Or is it relatively similar and there's not really that much of a difference? And so using all the statistical stuff, I'm able to compare across a bunch of different species of electric fish and looking at their skull shape to kind of see how it's changed over time and what it looks like now in terms of form and function, so how it's working.
And when you get these results in, what can we do with this data and this information? How can we use this going forward, or what does this tell us?
Yeah, so a lot of people kind of have that question for me, especially because they think, you know, electric fish, like, how does that even relate to me?
Mm.
And a lot of times, I can't really give you a straight answer.
Yeah.
I can't say, yes, me studying the evolution of electric fish skull shape is going to directly impact your life. Chances are, probably not. But science is about increasing our knowledge. Yes. And who knows, maybe someday what I'm doing will lead to new methods that we can use for, you know, human skull development and comparing and looking at, you know, problems or abnormalities within development to figure out what we can do about birth defects or something like that. Also, a really cool thing about electric fish is they're actually able to regenerate their spine and spinal cord. So one of the, like, weird things about these fish is, you know, I was talking about, like, the kind of dissonance, the if two electric fish are, like, right next to each other, they don't really like it. One of the ways that they try to combat that is to bite the tails off of each other if they get too close. They're jerks. Some species are more jerky than others, but in essence, they can be jerks. And so a fish might lose a portion of the back half of its body. And what does it do? It doesn't just sit there and like, oh no, that sucks. It grows it back. And so my, you know, research with skull evolution might not be directly tied to that, but these fish are really cool. They can do that. So there's definitely, I mean, no matter what you're looking at, there are probably ways that the organisms that we're studying that kind of seem far out or like unattainable, not really related to you, there's probably a reason that we're studying them, and they might actually have some impact on your life someday. So
I love the way nature does stuff, and especially with fish and amphibians and reptiles, just the way they go, oh, I've lost that, don't worry, bam, new one. And you're like, what, you can't just, what? Like, you got to share that with
us. Like, we have little skinks here, little amphibians, and they'll just, like, drop their tail if they get freaked out. They'll just lose it. They'll just
and
drop
just crack
it.
On.
It's gone. No. Grow a new one.
Yeah, it's absolutely, it's just unbelievable that these animals can do, like, axolotls do the same thing. They can regrow organs, for Christ's sake. And it's just amazing that these animals can do stuff like that. The last question I'll ask you is, this is a question every guest on the show gets asked. If you could pass on one bit of advice to everyone on the planet, if they could all hear this bit of advice regarding the natural world, what would you pass on to everyone?
Oh, goodness. I would tell everyone to just get outside. I think that was kind of one of the things that got me passionate about biology and nature and really gave me, you know, a passion for trying to make sure that we can do everything we can to save it. So get outside, even if it's for 5 minutes a day in your backyard. It's better than nothing. I've spent more time birding in my backyard, honestly, since the pandemic hit, and I think I've done in quite a while. But if you just go out there and look, you'll start to see some of those amazing intricacies and cool things that nature does, and it'll give you a huge appreciation for it, I think.
Amazing. Cassandra, thank you so much for joining me for today's show. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, and I wish you all the best of luck with the rest of your paper that you're writing about skull shape, and I can't wait to see it out there on the internet.
Thank you. It was so much fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and shows that Cassandra is working on, you can do so on Twitter and Instagram at CassTheFish. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify and Podbean. You can also get in touch on social media at IntoTheWildPod. Whether it's just to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or even let me know what you'd like to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.